Hello and welcome to episode 8 of The Northern Line. In this episode, we'll be chatting with Joe Cosgrove, who's currently standing for election to the RCOA Council. We'll also talk to him about his work on end-of-life care planning and his work with Compassion in Dying. We're also joined by Matt Tuck to discuss more issues related to pay, contracts and localing. But first, as always, some important dates for your diary.
So we have some dates for events going on locally and nationally over the next few months. We've got local events such as the MEPA course, which has dates on the 7th of March, 13th of June and the 16th of November for all those interested in paediatric anaesthetic emergencies. We've got practical procedures course for intensive care trainees. That's on the 31st of March next year. And the North East Obstetric Anaesthetic Meeting on the 25th of the January 2022. There are also some post-fellowship teaching dates. You can see Barbara's email for reminders of these. But there's one on the 26th of January, which focuses on pain, one on the 3rd of March, focusing on coagulation, and one on the 9th of May, focusing on regional anaesthesia. There's also one on the 1st of July, but the topic is yet to be announced. In terms of national events going on, we've got some events from the Royal College of Anaesthetists. On the 7th of December, there's a free ACCS trainee day. And on the 8th of December, there's also a webinar on doctors' health and well-being and putting that into practice. On the 9th of December, there's their annual general meeting. And on the 13th of December or the 10th of March, there's an online revision course for the final FRCA, if any of you are sitting exams. On the 7th of February, they have a leadership and management, the essentials, which should be an online course. And from the 9th to the 11th of February, there's the Anaesthetic Updates Conference, if anyone wishes to attend. Other things from the Association of Anaesthetists, they remember they have webinars that are free for members. And on the 9th of December, they've got an online webinar on bleeding, clotting and hemorrhage, an update. And on the 13th of December, there's one for paediatric anaesthesia, what's new for 2022. There's also their winter scientific meeting on the 13th to the 14th of January. And then there's a new standards monitoring guidelines, intra-op and perioperative glucose monitoring on the 1st of February. And on the 3rd of February, they're talking about the new SAS contracts, including specialist roles for SAS. Remember that there's a lot of content on the association's website that is free for all members, and it's worth having a look at if you're expecting to do exams, or it's also useful for updates. For the ITU trainees, there's an FFICM prep course from the 7th to the 8th of March 2022. You're not able to book online yet, but it's definitely one to look out for. Also a reminder that there's a relaunch of Northeast Research Network for Anaesthesia and ICM, which used to be Incarnet. If you're interested, we got an email from Barbara about it recently and to contact Nicola Powley. She's also hopefully going to appear on this podcast in the new year, so if you're interested, also give that a listen too. Remember to check the A-Line website if you're interested in any of the local courses. You can book online there, and you can also have a look at what's upcoming in the next few months.
Thank you, Jess. Another reminder that anyone with an upcoming ARCP needs to get the paperwork in very soon, so please don't forget. As you may already be aware, the RCOA are currently holding elections to appoint new members to council. Currently, there are no representatives from the North East on council, but we have two excellent consultants who are standing for election, Ian Whitehead and Joe Cosgrove. Both have plenty of experience and would do a great job if elected. We're now going to speak with Joe Cosgrove about the election and his work with the End of Life Working Party and Compassion in Dying. Hello, Dr. Cosgrove. Thank you for joining us on the Northern Line. For anyone who hasn't met you before, would you mind giving us a bit of an introduction about yourself?
Yeah, my name's Joe Cosgrove. I'm a consultant in anaesthesia and intensive care at the Freeman Hospital in Newcastle. I've been there for nearly 22 years now, and I graduated from Newcastle University in 1988, and most of that time has been spent in anaesthesia and intensive care, with little sojourns into medicine and neonates, and actually general practice and emergency medicine as well.
I've covered a lot of the specialties there. So we thought we'd talk to you today because we knew that you're standing for election to the Council of the Royal College of Anaesthetists, and just thought it would be nice to chat with you and just get a bit more information about that. So really why you've decided to apply and why at this particular stage in your career.
If I go back 5 or 6 years, it was never anything that sort of entered my mind to consider. I kind of looked at my mid to late 50s as being a gentle move towards retirement. Clearly, with COVID, that hasn't happened for any of us. And I think across the specialties, it's impacted our careers in all sorts of different ways. As trainees, you don't need me to tell you how difficult life has been for you. But it's also, I think, impacted upon consultants at my stage of the career as well. Some of it, paradoxically, has been quite positive in that I think the last 18 to 20 months have demonstrated the importance of anaesthesia and intensive care medicine, and for that matter, pain management as well, demonstrated the importance towards how a hospital runs on a day-to-day basis. I think this was first highlighted when we were sort of front and centre of the initial response to COVID last March, but clearly with the desire to reset and recover, it's becoming increasingly evident how important sort of perioperative medicine and intensive care medicine are going to be to that process. So over the last 18 to 20 months, I started to consider whether I should be doing anything else within my career. And I think through circumstance rather than anything else, rather than any sort of long-term planning on my part, I've found myself thrust into a media spotlight representing intensive care medicine and anaesthesia on the media, both mainstream and social media. And it's kind of from that and discussing issues with other people that I've been encouraged by some of my peers to consider applying for counsel. And I think to add into that as well, having been an examiner for the last 12 years, found myself becoming increasingly involved with the workings of the college from the perspective of exams. And likewise, having had colleagues in anaesthesia and intensive care medicine encourage me around the country, some of my examiner colleagues as well have felt that I apparently have what it has to try and become an effective council member.
So it sounds like you're already very familiar with a lot of the workings of the college, so you're in a really good position to take up a seat within the council.
The answer to that is both yes and no. I think yes, from the exam perspective, I'm very familiar with that and have had a senior role within the final FRCA for the sort of 3 to 4 years leading into the pandemic, in terms of reformatting the exam and expanding the number of SOEs, etc., and trying to increase question writing and increase the database of questions. But the College Council has a much wider net than just obviously the final FRCA, and it touches upon lots of things, in particular liaison upwards with politicians, liaison outwards with the public, and clearly liaison downwards with all the acute NHS trusts in the country. I think the college is very keen to emphasise that we need to be front and centre of hospital services, because without us, whether it's operations, whether it's pain management, whether it's obstetrics, resource, anything, without us, teams cannot function without the skills of an anaesthetist. That appeals to me, getting that message across. I think during COVID, with my media appearances, it would appear from the comments of others that I have a knack of explaining things to the general public in a way that is easy for them to understand, and actually getting the message across about how valuable we are to any healthcare system, and obviously in our case, to the NHS. So it's kind of through that, as well as the promptings, as I mentioned earlier, of colleagues, that I felt that I have something to offer the specialty in terms of engaging with the general public, and possibly even engaging with politicians as well.
That might be quite the challenge. On a personal note, I've shared a lot of your social media posts, and I know that my family have very much appreciated that, and I find it a lot easier to understand than my attempts.
Okay, well, that's very reassuring and nice to hear. Thank you.
No problem.
It would be nice to have some representation from the North East if you or Ian were elected to council.
I don't think it's the fault of the college, but it's increasingly over the last few years, it seems to have become more London-centric in terms of council members. That is not deliberate, and I think that's more circumstance, in that given the pre-COVID situation with people having to travel the night before to get to a meeting, to stay in London overnight and then face a long journey back the following evening, I think it was discouraging, discouraged people rather from further north, particularly the northeast of England and Scotland, and I would suggest Northern Ireland as well, as it discouraged them from applying because of the general inconvenience of travel. That's changed. There will still be, I think, 9 council meetings a year, but for the foreseeable future, only 4 of them are scheduled to be in London. And one of the positive aspects of the pandemic is that because of video conferencing, we can now hold a lot of the meetings online and actually reduce the need for lots of us to travel a long way at our inconvenience. And also, actually, because the college is also into a very green agenda and sustainability, reduce the carbon footprint of the council members as well.
Moving on from the council election, you've recently been involved with end-of-life care planning. Could you tell us a bit about this, please?
I was chair of the end-of-life working party for the Faculty of Intensive Care Medicine. And that was a 2.5-year project designed to highlight best practice in end-of-life care within an intensive care setting, but also to highlight issues around decision-making and advanced care planning as well. And this is something that I've had a career-long interest in, in fact, actually almost a lifelong interest, in that I have a number of now long dead family members who were very clear about what they would want and what they wouldn't want should they be dying. And now clearly medical technology, etc., has advanced quite a lot, and some of the things that they died of, they would have probably survived for years afterwards if they'd have undergone treatment. But I think the principle of the patient advocating what they want and working with the clinicians rather than the clinicians telling them what we can and can't do is something that all good doctors, all good healthcare professionals should abide by. It's really just through an sort of informal advocacy of that I was approached by FICM in 2017 to chair a working party. And it's from that we produced our documents in September 2019. As I said, looking at not only just good end-of-life care, but also effective decision-making and effective advanced care planning. And that was a multidisciplinary group, including patient representatives and including representatives from the hospice environment as well. And the work that we produced, I think, was of significant value for a lot of us, actually, at the start of the pandemic, in terms of guiding how we approached care of patients. And it's actually from that my media appearance began, actually, because one of the groups that we worked with was an organisation, a charity called Compassion in Dying, that likes to promote advanced care planning. And in March of last year, they approached me to go on Any Answers on a Saturday on Radio 4 to talk about advanced care planning, and also to talk about issues around death on intensive care and complicated grief experienced by family members. Because obviously, I'm sure everyone remembers at the time, there was a lot of talk about intensive care. There was a lot of talk about people not being refused intensive care because of age, etc. So I think Compassion in Dying were very keen to get across the issue of advanced care planning and patients and families taking control as much as clinicians, but also explaining that there were significant burdens attached to intensive care. And you can only really give any overview about what you would want if you not only understand the benefits of intensive care, but you also understand the burdens of intensive care. And knowing that, you can work with your loved ones and clinicians to actually come up with something that is of hopefully of benefit to you. But if it isn't of absolute benefit in terms of life saving, it will afford you a chance to have some control over how you're cared for during your last few days, weeks, months of life.
If there's another upside, it's probably not the right word, but of the pandemic, is that more people will hopefully have thought about these issues and perhaps had some conversations that they may not have had with their relatives.
There is evidence to actually say that that has happened. I know Compassion in Dying have actually, they obviously keep a log of how many people approach the website, how many actually people then draw up some form of advanced care plan with the advice that they offered. And compared to, I think, April 2019, there was, I've not got the figures in front of me, but in terms of both clicks on the website, there was about a 100-fold increase in clicks on the website. And there was about, I think, 150% increase in uptake of advanced care plans as well. They have some evidence to prove that that has happened. And at a local level within the Newcastle Mountain Hospitals, I know our palliative care team have did a lot of work to that effect as well. And it's very clear that a lot of, not just patients with COVID, but a lot of patients coming in through acute admissions, if they haven't already got some form of advanced care plan, it hasn't come as a surprise to the patients and the families when doctors start to talk about these things. So clearly, I'm hopeful that we have had an impact for the better, but also, you know, this is something that needs to carry on beyond my career, even beyond sort of the trainees' careers, and really sort of embed it in society.
It's getting to be a little bit late by the time the conversation comes up
with
relatives. So the more encouragement people have to make this something that's just the same way that you know, get your house insurance or get, you know, plan for your retirement, that you should be planning for, you know, what you may or may not want.
Well, yeah, and that's what's interesting is that, you know, pre-pandemic, the Compassion in Dying had some data to demonstrate that several million people in the UK had lasting power of attorney, or the Scottish and Northern Irish equivalents of lasting power of attorney for finance and property. But only hundreds of thousands of people had lasting power of attorney for health and welfare. And you know, it's interesting, the clearly having an LPA of whatever sort is an indication that you accept that one day you're going to die, and one day you might not be in a position to look after your own affairs as you approach death, so you'd want somebody else to do it on your behalf. But we seem obsessed with doing it for our finances and our properties, but we don't want anyone to do it with our health and welfare, which kind of, that may reflect other things that are happening in society about our materialism and everything. But it is interesting that there is an acceptance that something's going to happen to us, but, and we want our properties sorting out and our bank accounts sorting out, but we don't necessarily want our health and welfare sorting out.
Is everyone is aware that they won't live forever, but nobody likes to really consider how that may occur, that it won't just be necessarily that you go to sleep one night and that's it.
And I think that's why the works of the likes of Kath Mannix in the last few years have been so important. And it's great to know that Kath's actually from the Northeast and that she's influenced so many people, both clinically and outside healthcare, into thinking about these things.
So you're pretty busy within work and pretty busy outside of work. Is there anything that you like to do that's not related to work? Just as a sort of final question.
Well, outside of work, as most people know, sport features quite heavily in my life. Competing has long gone. My knees and my ankles don't permit even effective running anymore. But I'm still involved, particularly in cricket, as a cricket umpire in the north of England, which I've been doing for about 5 years now. I really enjoy it. It can be very stressful because you have to make very quick decisions sometimes, not always to everybody's satisfaction. Ironically, I think my life as an intensivist, having had important conversations with people, do actually help me deal with it. What's also quite interesting is that I think because doctors are trained to write things down as they happen, as if there are any controversial moments through a game, I've actually been able to record them quite effectively, and they've been able to be dealt with in a calmer environment at a later date. And I think a lot of lot of, whilst I'm not as experienced as some of my colleagues out there umpiring, I think that those sort of habits have rubbed off on a lot of them, because there is sometimes a tendency to just to let things rise because, sorry, let things ride because an apology was issued and people have promised never to behave like that again, and then clearly they do. But, and I think, I mean, on a serious note, I don't know if you're aware, but there's a select committee meeting going on this morning with the Department of Culture, Media and Sport about racism in cricket. And I found that fascinating because the leagues I umpire in do have a well-represented South Asian population of cricketers, and it's been very interesting. It's been a learning curve for me to know how they've and their families have sort of evolved in terms of acceptance into the game. And I think if you go back, certainly going back 30 years, things were awful at league level, and a lot of non-white cricketers had to form their own clubs. They weren't accepted in all sorts of areas of the country, but particularly in some areas of the north of England. And I think that at grassroots level is changing. It's clear from the select committee meeting this morning that there's a lot of work that needs to be done. And I think that's actually, back to healthcare and anaesthesia, I think that's certainly something that I'm impressed with regard to the Royal College of Anaesthetists, is its inclusivity. I think having worked as an examiner for 12 years, having worked in an anaesthetics department for 20 years as a consultant, compared to when I was a medical student and a trainee, there's been great inroads, certainly at shop floor level, for inclusivity. And I think it's those habits, because I'm from a very white background in the north of England. I never met any non-white person until I went to university. And I think a lot of my generation are like that. And I think it's been an absolute fantastic educational journey over the last sort of 40 years. And I think having gone through what we've gone through in healthcare at shop floor level and seeing the way the college works, I think I've got something to actually take back into cricket on a Saturday afternoon in the summer as well, if things start to get out of hand. So that's it. So yeah, cricket, it can be stressful, but it isn't having difficult conversations with grieving families. It's having difficult conversations with 25-year-old, usually men, who think that they should be playing test match cricket for England, but really aren't that good enough.
A little bit of a lack of insight, perhaps, for them. Thank you very much for your time, and good luck with your with the election. And we'll hopefully hear some positive news and perhaps hear back from you later next year.
Great. Thanks, Sarah.
If you haven't yet voted, please do take the time to do so. It would be fantastic to have Joanie in as part of the RCOA Council. We're now going to speak with Matthew Tuck. He's previously given us an update on how to understand your pay back in episode 6, and he's going to now talk about some other issues related to pay, contracts and locoming.
Hello, Matt. Thank you for joining me again.
No problem at all, Johnny. It's good to be doing it.
So today, we're following on from our discussion previously on the podcast, where we discussed how our pay is calculated and where this can commonly go wrong. So today, we'd like to discuss, firstly, a little bit about the pay protection that's in place for more senior trainees who began their training on the old pay scale and how that all works. And then we're going to talk about how pay works out for those doctors who are in trust grade roles or doing time out of training or perhaps doing CT3 top-up posts, and how pay works there. And then at the end, we might discuss a little bit about the pay for locum shifts or for locum roles and how that all works out. So Matt, would you like to start us off by telling us a bit about this pay protection, which is in place for senior trainees who began training on the old contract?
Yeah, I mean, it seems like a long time ago now, doesn't it? 2016. The new contract, that as everyone still calls it, is over five years old this year. And there were, at the transition point, a couple of kind of fudges that were made to protect certain groups of doctors. And over time, that group has dwindled because people have been completing their training. But I think from looking at the dates, if you are still in anaesthetic training, and in August 2016, if you were CT3 or above, at that time and you still not finish your training, you will be affected by what's called Schedule 2 pay protection. So there are two types of pay protection put into this transition kind of arrangement between the contracts to try and prevent anyone from moving on and then losing career earnings or losing month-to-month pay compared to how they were before. The first type of pay protection probably doesn't apply to anyone. It was meant at any point anymore. It was meant to prevent you kind of as an F2 moving from a kind of well-banded job to a different job and then suddenly losing all this money because of the way the contract worked. Most people now earn more than they would have as an F2 or an F1, so it shouldn't apply. So let's just talk about this second type. The old pay scale had an annual increment and was very stepwise and would increase every year from your first year of training all the way through during periods of statutory leave, during periods of academic placement, everything. You get an increment each year. If you were at the point of CT3 in that 2016 period, if you had moved to the new pay scale at that time, like everyone else did below you, then you would have fallen and had the worst of both scenarios. So you'd have missed out on the front loading of pay that now exists in training. So you get more of your career earnings earlier on in training. But then you'd have been on this sort of plateau and not earned any more increments till you finished training. So you wouldn't have had that front loading and you'd have missed out on your increments afterwards. So that was a group of people that was identified as being particularly disadvantaged. So there was what's called Schedule 2 pay protection. And what that meant was the only difference to you and anyone else is that your pay scale remains on the old increment system so that you would increment each year as you did before so that you weren't disadvantaged in your total sort of time and training career earnings. This is a lot of words. It sounds quite particularly troubling to work out. But basically, if you were CT3 in 2016, in August 2016, if you started your year in CT3 or you were halfway through one as a February starter, then this probably applies to you, as long as you haven't taken a full career break, so you've terminated your employment and restarted, because then you'd be treated as a new starter and there wouldn't be this kind of transition. And what this means is that your pay follows the old scale and that it will continue to do so. And it was always time limited. Originally, it was 2021, 2022. That seemed like a long way away back then. And in the renegotiation in the last 2 years, that's been extended to 2025. But as time goes by, the numbers of people that affect gets less and less as people complete training. So that is a small population, probably, or it may not be, but it's something that's relevant to you and might mean that your pay slip looks a little bit different to your more junior colleagues in training and your pay calculations look a little different. If you're confused by that, there's an explainer on the BMO website. There is also explainers on kind of other medics money sites as well about that. And as always, if there's any concerns about it, just get in touch. Just have a check because you want to make sure that you're being paid appropriately. Because if you're not getting your increment each year, you could be down a couple of grand each year. And if that adds up.
Thanks for clearing that up. It's important. It's an important point, isn't it? And am I right in saying most people who are on the old contract will know that they're on the old contract? Is there an easy way to see? But for these more senior trainees who've been in training for some time?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you raise an interesting point. Everything is sort of deemed the new contract. We are all on the new contract. The wording of the contract that is given to you or not given to you, but is available online, applies to absolutely everybody. It is only the pay scale that now differs for these people. So all the things about rest are all the 2016 or the 2018 amended contract. They are all for you. So the hours limits, all that is in place. It's just the pay. So it is hard to say. There is a code on your pay slip that may look a bit odd, and it might mean that you see all the pay calculations listed and then suddenly your pay is much more than what that calculation would be. And that's because that fudge has been applied, that pay protection has been applied. Ultimately, if you have been in continuous employment and in August 2016 you were CT3 or above and you're still in training, this probably affects you. So if you're listening to this and you think that describes you, then you should probably be on Schedule 2 pay protection, paid on the old pay scale, and entitled to your yearly increments, which, if you've been less than full-time and been in training for a number of years, does get slightly higher than the current highest nodal point on the new pay scale. So there is stuff to be gained by checking.
Okay, great. Thanks very much. So I think we can move on from that now, because as you've rightly said, that's sort of a minority of trainees, isn't it? Next, we're going to discuss a little bit about sort of pay for trust grade doctors and sort of those who are maybe doing these CT3 top-up posts or doing some time out of training, as one of those doctors myself. I've noticed when sort of perusing NHS jobs that there does seem to be quite a range of sort of salaries advertised for these roles. Going off the BMA website, you know, CT3 or ST3 pay starts at £50,017 on the 2016 contract, but this doesn't always seem to be what's advertised, even if these jobs are pitched as a sort of, you know, ST3 level equivalence. Sometimes it's 38,000 or you know, it can vary quite significantly. So is there any sort of entitlement that trust grade jobs have to sort of pay equivalence with trainees, or is it completely up to the trust to just decide what they want to pay us?
Unfortunately, the answer is that they can offer the terms they want to, and if you are willing to accept those terms, then that's what they are. There is always scope for negotiation. If you're looking at a job that's advertised and there is a salary scale, so starting at and going to, they usually provide a range, that means that that post has probably been designed and packaged by HR to mirror the old pay scale, whereby you might be going in at a role that was badged at ST3 or CT3, but if you'd done additional years of service within the NHS as a doctor, you could potentially argue that your increment pay is higher, and so you should come in at a greater salary. There's no requirement that an employer use the new pay scale to employ you as a trust grade, but they can. And so if you see a post that you like, people should be asking, why are you not using this new pay scale? Why are you putting a new job out using a scale that is 19 years old, nearly two decades old, which seems to me a bit strange. It's also not excellent in terms of attracting people as an employer. So as you rightly point out, the nodal point four, which is ST3 or anyone who's completed core training or in their third year of specialty training, as that will be more relevant as the new curriculum people get up to that point, is much, much higher. So the difference, if you've just plain sailed through and you've done F1, F2, CT1, CT2, and you now find yourself in this CT3 role, the difference for you between the new and old pay scale for that experience that you have could be about 12 grand over the course of the year. And that is assuming some things about your average work intensity. If you're working quite intensive shifts with lots of nights and weekends, then actually that difference might be much greater. So ultimately the trust can offer what they want, and they, you know, if you accept it, that's what it is. But it does mean that actually, unlike a job in training, there is scope to negotiate. There is scope to ask for these things. If you're paid on an old pay scale, your protective system for your kind of establishing what your hours are going to be and protecting you from being overworked is the old monitoring system. So make sure that's mentioned in your terms, because they don't have to put it in there, but they should. It's always worthwhile getting someone that knows this stuff to check over your contract of employment if you're applying for these roles. I know that they're difficult to get before the start date. Push for it. If you can get it and get it checked, either by someone you know who has experience in it, or trade unions usually offer those services, they can warn you about things that are missing or problematic, or leave open things open to interpretation, which is good for you. And it means that you know what you're getting when you're going into it.
Sorry to interrupt, Matt. Am I right in saying, to pick up on what you just said, that as a trust grade doctor, you're not necessarily entitled to the same sort of rest period post-night as would be in the trainees contract?
You are absolutely right. And really, there's only two things, I think, preventing you from being worked harder on a day-to-day basis. And that is, they would have to construct two different rotors, which would be logistically difficult. And secondly, it would be bad press amongst the trainee population. There is nothing stopping them. So the hours limits that are prescribed by the contract for doctors in training do not apply. This is particularly worrying if you imagine that as we sort of decouple from all this EU legislation that we accepted into to British law, that the European Working Time Directive is never safe now. So that could be removed. And if you fall back through that on a trust grade contract, then you fall back on hours restrictions that are nearly, you know, 30 years old. The only thing preventing them from doing that to you really is the trouble it would take to make a special rotor just for you that was worse. So it's not great. So a contract of employment for a trust grade role that mirrors that for doctors in training is straightforward to produce. It's very easy. The problem is, from an employer's perspective, is it's more investment because your pay is higher. And that is the only thing stopping them from using it, because ultimately it's actually a smaller contract. It's more concise. It's easier because it fits in with what everyone else is doing. It's just money.
Yeah, you're right. And so just another question. This is useful for me as someone who's going to be applying for these CT3 sort of top up roles. I think I'm right in saying that the Royal College or the Association of Anaesthetists has offered sort of guidance for these CT3 top up roles, and that people who are doing these roles should basically be treated as equal to trainees. However, in my experience, these jobs aren't being advertised as CT3 top up posts. They're being advertised as a trust grade job in anaesthetics, where it is possible for you to gain the competencies required for CT3 jobs. So is that kind of a way of them getting around treating doctors in these roles as, you know, doctors in training and more as sort of, you know, trust grade doctors?
Yes. The short answer is yes. In the wake of the curriculum change and this creation of the kind of destabilizing, along with other factors, clearly with recruitment, destabilizing this situation, the Association of Anaesthetists, the BMA, and the Royal College jointly produced recommendations for sort of best practice for creating these roles and things that we would see as gold standards. So if you want people to achieve their outcomes, this is the best way to do it. This is the fairest way to do it. It is, however, not mandated. So there are things like parity of access to study leave, study budget, which are not guaranteed in trust grade roles. Most hospitals have development funds for roles that are not training roles, but you share this with everyone who's on a trust grade or staff grade contract in the trust, and they're frequently raided when times are lean because it's seen as an easy win for other budgets, and clearly the study leave. So, you know, these you guys in going to CT3 roles have educational outcomes. You've got curriculum outcomes to obtain, but you're shortchanged and shorthanded by the system because, you know, someone in training at the same grade as you is achieving the same outcomes, except they have all this resource to help them. So that's where that guidance came in. It is, to guard my words, it is unfortunate that this had to be a post hoc piece of work. It didn't have to be. It is, however, where we are. Ultimately, the standards are there. So if you're someone right now in training who is unfortunately been successful in application, first of all, there are many of you. You aren't alone. This is not an individual problem just for you. This has affected a huge amount of people, hundreds over the, you know, in the country, maybe more. And there are standards. So start looking at them. And when you're looking through jobs, use it as a guide to see where you want to be. And if there's time for application, you know, ask the people who've listed these jobs, what of these can you achieve? Which of these do you think you're going to be able to deliver? Because ultimately, at the end of that year, you're going to need some proof of what you've done. And if they've not designed in your job ways for you to achieve these things or pay you properly for it, then you're going to have a harder time. So it's a really unfortunate situation. However, there are some guidelines. They're not mandatory, but basically, it's a huge work backlog of anaesthetic work. There is a huge resource pressure on intensive care. People want you. They're not doing you a favor. It's not charity by employing you. You're skilled people. So they will want to offer something that attracts people in the region. So ask them to do better.
Yep, you're right. And you're right in what you've said. And certainly, you know, all the consultants and clinical directors and things, I'm sure they'll be happy to employ as many of us as possible, but that's not always, you know, where the money comes from. And it might be, you know, fewer jobs than necessarily are required, but anyway, we can probably leave that point there before we get too sort of nihilistic about the whole thing. Is there anything else you wanted to mention about the pay in particular for these sort of locally employed doctors?
It's an interesting point is that I started as a doctor in 2014, and I did my F1 year, F2 year, and the first few months of my CT1 year on the old pay system. So I kind of, in my brain, understand banding, which is what the system was. It was applied to your base salary to produce your final salary. And it, you know, it was a product of how, what proportion of the hours you do in a week are antisocial. So I'm relatively familiar with that. But as the guys come through who may be more in your situation or you're now in CT1 or 2, worried about your applications or thinking you might be taking these posts out of training. And if people are still offering contracts based on your pay scale, I think it's important to understand how that pay is calculated. Effectively, it's a little bit more simplistic than the new pay scale, because it was designed to reduce the 100-hour working week. So it's kind of not very helpful at the sort of hours that we work now. But basically, you have a basic salary, and then you have roughly 40 or 50% as an anaesthetic trainee, it's unlikely to be anything less, applied as a banding uplift. And that is checked each year with a monitoring exercise, sort of a diary card. And if you're proven to be working beyond that, then the whole of your employed period is banding has changed, so you could be due back pay. So you don't necessarily have exception reporting if you've been used to that. It will affect the amount you pay towards your pension, because your basic pay will be less, and that is the only thing your pension is calculated on. So there are take-home pay implications rather than just the raw figure on the kind of job offer. If you've got any, it's difficult to kind of get any more granular than that over a podcast without the individual circumstances. But if anyone's concerned, again, just get in touch, and we can always have a rough chat through and find the next steps. So again, if you're going to be facing those roles and you're not familiar with the system, just get in touch.
And presumably all of the things we spoke about last time still apply. And by that, I mean things about making sure your work schedule that you get at the start of your employment, is what you're actually working. And if there's any, sort of things that don't match up there, then ensuring that that's corrected and you're sort of paid appropriately for those shifts.
I mean, that's really interesting, Johnny, because there's the fact of the matter, if you're on the TS2 on a trust grade, you won't get a work schedule. So the whole system of payment is based on assumptions of your rota. So the system for knowing if you're being paid right on the old system is, here's my rota over the course of so many weeks. Is that accurate to what I'm working? And so then once, if the rota is accurate and that's the hours you're working, then you can look down and say, right, how many of the hours I'm working are outside of playing time? How many hours in total am I working on average? And that gives you your banding. So you won't get a work schedule. You'll get a rota, and you'll get told your pay. And then you've got to wait a couple of weeks, months down the line to see if actually what you're working is correct. So again, it's quite a post hoc kind of system. So again, there'll be people out there who just weren't used to that way of working, and it'll be completely alien. And where there's a lack of kind of familiarity, there's potential for at worst exploitation, but at the softest sort of just gentle negligence.
Yep, that's a nice way to put it. So that's interesting. Thanks very much for that. So that's definitely something to look out for. And we're talking, a lot about these sort of CT3 posts here, but presumably the same things apply for people who are taking time out of training to do, fellowships or any other sort of out of training posts.
Yeah, completely. So if you're taking a career break, so you're finishing court or ACCS and you're doing something else before applying for another specialty role, higher specialty training, then yes, that all applies. Things are slightly different. If you are in a formal training program, say you're ST4 or 5, and you want to go and row competitively at the Olympics and you need time out for that, that's different. You may not have to resign. So your systems may be slightly different, or you want to go and do a role, for example, with HEMS in London, and you can get it approved as a part of your training. That's slightly different, because you may remain employed by the systems up here and pay, and it's all the money is just sorted out behind the scenes. So it may vary. But basically, if your contract runs out and you are taking a post where a trust pays you as opposed to the let, then it can be any system. So it could be the new pay scale and contract terms. It could be the old pay scale and contract terms. And equally, if you've been a trust grade for many years, I mean, maybe people listening to this who've been in trust grade roles in one trust for many years, you could be thinking, or should be thinking, about whether or not you could be paid on a staff grade role, or increasingly, if you are more senior within, say, for example, anaesthetics, there are now specialty doctor roles, which become with much more pay and better terms, that are meant to be rewarding senior anaesthetic practitioners, doctors, who haven't been progressing through a formal training program, but yet provide highly autonomous care. So if that's you, if you're listening, hello, and you've been in a trust grade all 5-6 years, they owe you more than they're giving you. So ask for it.
And is that just a negotiation between the doctor and the trust to sort of move from you know, a trust grade job to a specialty doctor job?
It's very much, you know, going to the clinical director on the list. It's very much like the people we'll be familiar with when they're wanting to get consultant jobs. You suddenly have to finish your exam, and then after that, you've got to start like making cupcakes for people.
Yes.
It's very much a similar schmoozing situation.
I see. Okay, very good. And so, as there are all these sort of shortages across routers, there's more and more locum posts being advertised, and I'm sure there's plenty in hospitals where you work. Is there anything that you wanted to mention about sort of pay for locum posts? I mean, or sort of filling in gaps here and there? Is it as simple as just, you know, agreeing a rate beforehand and making sure you're paid for that rate? Is there anything more to it than that?
There is a little more to it, but not a huge amount. But the gist of what you've said is absolutely right. So it's a seller's market. You have some additional time. You're not duty bound to provide it. There is a clause in our training contract that if a gap appears within 48 hours, so not long term. So say, for example, where we are now, where Thursday was time of recording. If suddenly in the next 48 hours, there's an unexpected gap, the cohort as a whole will be responsible potentially for providing someone to fill it. Now, that is incredibly complicated to enforce because it's not on an individual, it's on the cohort as a whole. So it's very odd. But ultimately, there's usually always someone who eventually the terms meet their threshold for wanting to do the work. So it works out okay. But long-term gaps, there's no obligation, and it is effectively whatever you want. Some places will say we have caps, we have these agreed rates. But as many people know, these change and can change wildly depending on the need for the shift cover. If you are working at a site as a lead employer doctor, as a doctor in training, and you're doing additional shifts, most of the hospitals in this region will pay you through the let, which is very good because it means it all comes to your salary. There's no additional tax codes for separate employment. So there's no kind of huge deductions and tax stuff. So that's very helpful. Some sites prefer to do their own system, so we'll pay you on a separate employee number, and that can wreak havoc with deductions and stuff. So sometimes by the time you work it all out, the financials of it sometimes don't make sense. You know, ask if it combinations of things, it may not be the raw rate, you might say, okay, I'll do it for that, but I also want the days off afterwards as well. Or if you're moving from days to cover a night, you might still want the rest days included as sort of a bit of a perk, sort of a soft benefit. Those are all things you can discuss, and just make sure you get things in writing. Unless you absolutely trust that rotor coordinator with your life, and there are a few in the region who I would say that of, but otherwise get it in writing, because otherwise it can be difficult afterwards. And yeah, just make sure your forms are in on time, and then hopefully you'll get it within a month, but that's a big hopefully. But yeah, just know your worth, and ultimately the people of all walks in the health system, including the consultants, are always negotiating their rates. And so should you.
Yeah, that's right. And yeah, like you said, you're not duty bound to do it. So make sure you're getting sort of appropriate benefit if you are doing extra shifts on top of an already busy router. Thanks very much, Matt. Is there anything else you wanted to mention just to tag on at the end of our discussion today?
I can't remember if I mentioned it last time. I'll mention it this time. So if you're in training, for the last 2 years, there's been a new nodal point now, ST6. And in April of 22, it will be reaching its sort of final value. So it'll be 7,000. Oh God, I'm going to be pulled apart. Can't remember a number wrong. I think 7,300. So you'll go from that 50,000 you said for the nodal point four. There's a fifth nodal point at ST6, and its value is somewhere over £7,000.
It's £56,077.
Currently, it's going to go up.
Currently.
It's going to go up one more time.
Oh, it's going to go up
April.
Even more.
It's going to go up one more time in April. Oh, yeah. and that is for anyone who's ST6 or above at that time. So if you're ST7, that will go up as well. And it just provides a bit more money to those people in the more senior roles, as we know that take on the more kind of responsible duties in hospitals and act up quite a lot of the time. So again, if you're ST6 or above right now or approaching ST6, and particularly for those in dual training, oh, we didn't talk about dual training at any point, Johnny, but that's important. If there's time, you can let me know. If not, we can come back and do dual training.
Yeah.
But any, basically, the, if at any point you are now ST6 or above, according to any curriculum, so dual curriculum or single curriculum, you should be getting paid the fifth nodal point if you're in training. It's a big chunk of money. And imagine going to ST6 and also going to Carlisle and getting their £7,000 a year pro rata. You'd be losing money by being a consultant.
And that seems wholly appropriate because, I mean, it does seem a bit strange that a you know, an ST3 gets paid the same or could potentially get paid the same as an ST7 or an ST8, which clearly they're not doing the same role. So yeah, that's good to know as well. And that's an important point. I think for dual training, I think that's probably something to leave for another day as we're going a little bit long.
That's fine.
We'll definitely get on maybe on next month's episode. So that's something to stay tuned for. So Matt, thanks very much for joining me again and for giving us all your expertise on the subject. And similar to last time, I'm sure you're happy for people to contact you directly or to send emails to the Northern Line sort of podcast email address. And if people have comments or questions or anything that wasn't clear, then we'll definitely pick those up on the next recording and we'll be happy to do so. So thanks very much, Matt.
Pleasure.
Thank you, Matt. It's so important that we do make the effort to understand our pay and our contracts. Mistakes can easily be made, but in most cases these can be corrected, but you have to know that they've happened first. And that rounds up everything for this month. Thanks once again for joining us, and we look forward to speaking with you again next month.